Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the president gets his day in court, at least his health care bill does. Is this a good thing or political destruction? His pizza's horrible, but Herman Cain knows how to deliver. Surprise results in Florida. No means no, unless you're Governor Chris Christie. Is he ready? Can he do it in time for 2012? Is this, in fact, his time? By the way, did you know that Congress is going to shut down government tomorrow? Woo! Another disaster averted. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And it's Tuesday here in the nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It has been a busy week here inside the Beltway here in the nation's capital. Lots of things going on, but we're going to do our introductions as we do every Tuesday this time. Sitting to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Welcome back, Al.
How are you?
Good to be fine. Here. He has served 4 presidents. He's got more political credibility than any of us around the table. He is a former Senate staffer and former Undersecretary of Commerce. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Alan, welcome back.
Thank you.
He is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation, NBC. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how you doing?
Always glad to be here.
And sitting to my right, he is the Vice President of China Affairs for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar certified attorney in Washington, D.C. and the great state of New York, Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be with everyone.
Yeah, hey, John Freshman, when you get a chance, call in. We miss you. Hey, lots of stuff going on this week. Big news coming out over the past 24 hours. It looks like the Obamacare, the Obama health care bill, whatever you want to call it, is going to go to the Supreme Court. There's a lot of buzz going on around this. The timing on it, I don't think, could be worse, but everybody's talking about it here inside the Beltway. Bob, we were talking about it beforehand. Tell me how it got to this point. It looks like that the Supreme Court's going to actually hear the case when it reconvenes for its fall docket, but it probably won't be till after the first of the year. Is that correct?
Yes. The court starts its hearing its cases in the first week in October. And they will probably not get the health care bill until they won't take it up until sometime after the first of the year. What we have is that 3 or 4 appellate courts, and I forget how many.
I think it's 4.
Have decided on both sides of the case.
Right.
And the Justice Department yesterday, I believe, decided not to appeal a 3-judge panel of the 11th Circuit down in Atlanta, which decided that it was unconstitutional. They decided it would just as well go to the Supreme Court. They decided not to ask for an en banc hearing. They will go directly to the court, so I would assume that they will do that in the next month or so, and I would further believe that the Supreme Court will have it. They will take it up sometime after January and probably decide it and announce the decision mid to late June next year, right in the middle of the campaign.
Which is going to be interesting. And by the way, you can join us live on the air. Any questions, any thoughts on any of the subjects we're talking about? You can call us toll-free if you happen to be in the area, code 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We'll get you right to the front of the line here on Backroom Politics. Al, are you a little bit surprised at the timing on this? Do you think that this is going to be a bad thing for the Obama White House as they go into the home stretch on an election campaign?
Probably, because you can probably figure out how the Supreme Court is going to decide on this, given their past biases. On the other hand, I think that it was inevitable it was going to go to the Supreme Court. they might as well just get it over with. What I would suggest is stop complaining about the timing and everybody figure out what your posture is going to be when they decide, whichever way they decide. The Republicans and the Democrats should both have, you know, a strategy for however which way it goes. And beyond that, I think you're just crocodile tears.
Well, Bob, when we look at the administration had the opportunity to ask the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals to hear the case or to rehear the case. They chose not to. They chose to go en banc, to go straight to the Supreme Court, bypassing the 11th Circuit Court. Legally, why does that make sense from the administration viewpoint? Is it just a matter of let's get it done and over with, or is there a legal tactic that's involved in this that would make sense for them to do it?
All right. Well, first, the 11th Circuit did take up the case. It was a three-judge panel rather than the entire 11-judge court. What the Justice Department decided to do was not to ask the en banc court, the full 11 judges of that court, including the three who are on the panel, to take a look at the case as a full court. The panel decided that it was unconstitutional in part. I think the Justice Department's decision is pretty clear. They felt it's going to get to the court. The Justice Department has a right to request that the court hear it en banc, but they don't have a right to insist upon it. And they felt that it was a serious question whether the court would even take the case, given the fact that so many courts have already decided it on both sides of the case. And it's really, you know, every issue has been talked about so many times, there's no need to talk about it again. I think they were looking at it, and reality says it's going to get there. Let's get it done. It's going to be up there shortly anyway.
Alan, politically, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, agree with these two. It was going to get to the Supreme Court, and given that, better sooner than later, so that the planning that is associated with this huge program can move forward without this huge legal uncertainty. So I think it's the smart thing to do to get an answer so we know what we've got.
You know, it's funny because one of the great law professors over at Georgetown Law, Randy Barnett, he was quoted recently in an article in Politico saying that the president and the solicitor general deserve full credit for refusing to employ delay tactics. And this is obviously a deep constitutional issue that has to be addressed and can only be addressed. We can go round and round with the appellate courts all day long, but ultimately this is going to happen. Legally, Ralph, do you agree with that?
I think so. I think it's important for there to be a final decision on the constitutionality of the health care bill. And it's going to come down to a fundamental question of whether the government can force people to buy health insurance. I mean, that's really the fundamental issue, and it's going to be very interesting to see how the court comes down on
that. Bob,
you could get a dozen of the best constitution lawyers in this country and sit them down and ask them to tell you what they think is the right decision, and I make you a bet, at the most, it would split 7-5. It probably would split 6-6. The constitutional question issue here is a very, very serious question. And it's a question that hasn't fundamentally been addressed directly, although it's been a number of cases. You can use a number of cases to cite why you could go either way on the decision. But it's a very difficult decision, and quite frankly, it needs to be decided.
But there's a definitive split in the appellate court system right now.
Yeah.
With you've got two, I believe you've got the 11th and the 6th. Voting one way, and then you have the fourth and fourth and fifth ruling another way. Is that going to play into the justices as far as how they're going to view this? Can the Supreme Court do a split on this and there be a dissenting vote possibly on either side?
My guess is it's going to be at best a 5-4 decision.
Really?
Yeah. There are several. I think the Democrats on the court are pretty firmly in the liberal camp, which means they're going to probably see the advantage that the government getting the revenues from the young people who don't have, who don't want to buy insurance, are going to have to buy insurance, which helps to pay for everybody else. They're going to see that as a reality that has to be faced if you're going to run a program. The Republicans are going to say, how can you force me to spend my money on something I don't want to spend it on when I'm an American citizen? How can the government tell me I have to spend my money a certain way? Those are two problems you can't solve easily.
Alan.
Anybody who ever tries to predict what the court is going to do gets into trouble. But I would not at all be surprised if the court, knowing how divisive this issue is so far in the circuit courts coming up, but knowing the importance of having the country united moving forward one way or the other, I'm going to predict that it's not unanimous, but closer to unanimous than these guys are suggesting. That we'll get a 7-vote majority. I don't know which way. It wouldn't surprise me if they say this is constitutional. It's not that different, arguably, one can argue, from what we do with Medicare. Everybody has to participate. Everybody gets the benefit. Now, you participate in a particular way through the tax code, you get a particular set of benefits. There's a lot more flexibility and opportunity for people to pick and choose what they purchase in this particular case. But I don't think they're going to necessarily turn into legislators. I think they're going to wrestle with this. But it wouldn't surprise me, because of the stakes involved, if they come together with a bigger majority than we're thinking than it looks like at the outset.
Ralph.
And it'll be also interesting to see if any of the justices try and cite cases from other countries like Canada or the UK, where there were cases brought by people that wanted to opt out of the national health insurance.
Well, that would be interesting. Can they use legal precedents from outside the U.S., and would that in fact have any traction with the Supremes? Bob?
Well, I think they can certainly review that kind. They can review those kinds of sources, but they're fundamentally going to have to deal with the precedents that they find in constitutional law under our system. But they can certainly review other, to get themselves fully immersed in the process. They can certainly study England. They can study Australia. They can study Canada, all of which has systems fairly similar to our own. They all come out of British common law.
Well, I mean, but still, the acting Solicitor General, because the President has not appointed a permanent Solicitor General, Walter Dellinger. Walter Dellinger's got himself a huge fight on his hands, and it's a sidebar that the Obama administration right now really doesn't need to be hampering their reelection campaign going into 2012. How do you offset something like that, Al?
Well, I don't think you can. I think this is one of those things that's just going to have to happen, and both sides are going to have to deal with it. I think probably it is less of a problem for the Republicans than it is for the Democrats, because of how I think the court is likely to go on this. But so what? I mean, nobody said being president was easy. You're just going to have to deal with it.
Well, let's look at this from the political standpoint. I mean, Al, you know, you look at a somewhat Democratic-leaning state like Washington, particularly up in your old district, and particularly in around the King County, Seattle area. This obviously plays well into that electorate. Is this something that, at least in Washington State, that you would see, look, you know, there's a lot of people that would be in favor of this, and kudos to the Obama administration. The administration could use this as a little bit of a boost?
Well, it seems to me it's whether the administration wants to argue about whether a Supreme Court decision was right or wrong. That is a perfectly pointless argument. Supreme Court will decide whichever way it is, that's the decision until something happens down the line. And I don't see where that particularly can be used as a helpful, it's something that the Democrats can complain about, but I don't think there's a lot of points. Because the question is going to be, what are you going to do about it now? You know, if the Supreme Court has just torn a hole in our health care system or our health care reform, and what are you going to do about it? And I think coming up with solutions may be a smarter political thing to do, and arguing about those than sitting around bitching about the Supreme Court.
Alan.
You know, there's an interesting sidebar question that will come up, especially if it's a really close vote, which I just predicted it wouldn't be that close. But does Elena Kagan recuse herself or not? She was working for the administration. She was not a key player on this.
She was Solicitor General.
But she, well, that's okay. I mean, the question is whether she was involved in the development of this policy. And she has not been recusing herself on cases. Nobody's made a big issue of that. But because this was such a centerpiece of what the Obama administration spent its early years on, for better or worse,
with her in a very senior position.
I should know the answer to this, but I don't. What if she recused herself and it came up 4-4? Does that mean that...
It wouldn't come up 4, most likely, but it could.
It could. It possibly could.
If Kennedy went over that way.
Right. Yes.
What I'm asking is...
Then the law, as it is written, would be sustained.
Yes. Okay.
Well, no, wait a second. Is it the law as it was written, or is it the...
It upholds the ruling of the appellate courts.
But they'd have to decide what they're going to do.
And
they'd have to come up with an answer. I don't know how they do it.
That could be very interesting.
I mean, this poses a very, very distinctive constitutional question. Yeah. I mean,
And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Republicans are going to be saying she should recuse herself in order to remove any doubt or confusion or concerns.
Right. On top of the fact that even if it does come out in favor of the administration and Justice Kagan does not recuse herself, there's going to be people that are going to say, hey, look, Justice Kagan was legislating from the bench. That's got to be a reality.
Then it becomes a political issue for the campaign.
No, absolutely.
Right.
I predict she won't recuse.
I do,
but
too.
But I've already predicted that I won't be 5-4. So.
We'll hold you to that.
What this?
Well, you'll have long forgotten.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we'll talk about that come January, February.
Almost any final solution, except a total rejection of the statute, I think, whether we're talking about Justice Kagan or anything else, I think almost anything the way you play it from the Republican standpoint, it's going to be a benefit in the campaign.
But you know, you look at what Dellinger said. He said in a couple of media outlets, including Politico, where he said this confirms, quote, this confirms what I had already concluded, that the government is confident that it's going to prevail in the Supreme Court and would like to have a decision sooner rather than later as far as their justification for bypassing another full unbinding court hearing in the 11th. That's sounding pretty cocky. They seem pretty confident that they're going to move forward and get this approved by the Supreme Court. But this is a matter of states' rights, and there are several. I guess the one question I have would be, is Justice Kennedy the lone silver bullet in all this, and can anybody even attempt to predict how Justice Kennedy would vote? Al?
No.
Alan?
No. I think we're getting to individuals, really, I mean, gets even trickier than guessing at the whole group. But I don't think we know. Based on history, where these people are going to come from, which is why I think it won't be as close as you all seem to think it is.
Bob?
This is such a fundamental question for the within constitutional law that I think it's very hard to determine how members who have never really looked at this kind of an issue are going to come down. I mean, I think I can see any number of justices finding this a very hard decision to make.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we're talking about individual rights. We're talking about state sovereignty. We're talking a multitude of issues. Is this a case that will keep rearing its ugly or pretty head, depending on which side of the aisle you're on? Is this something we're going to see, not unlike Roe v. Wade? Is this something that will come up every once in a while for a hearing? Ralph?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even if the Supreme Court says that the health care bill is constitutional, you're still going to have people trying to challenge it down the line. It's going to be like Roe v. Wade 30 years ago.
The reason it's going to be around for a long time is it's already been around for a long time. Harry Truman was not even the first one to begin to move into it, and we've debated this thing for 50 years. And the problem is that our healthcare system is broken, and it is in throwing this law out will not fix it. It may keep bad things from happening if you are of a certain perspective, but it won't solve the problem. So the problem continues, the issue continues, we'll be working with it for a long time.
Alan,
remember, we're not trying to, the whole law is not being challenged here. It's
right.
The question of whether the government can compel all individuals to buy insurance. That's the issue that will be before the court. Most of the law will not be before the court, and so we're going to have this law regardless. The question is, in order to implement it, you really need to know what the answer is to that particular question. I don't think it was great courage or cockiness that led the administration to do this. I think it was pragmatism. We know it's going to go to the court. Let's get it to the court. We've got too much at stake inside the executive branch and all over the country to the need to know what the rules are. Let's figure out what the rules are. I disagree that this is going to be an issue that's coming up 5, 10, 15, 20 years. In a couple of years, we're going to know whether this law was unraveled or repealed, not by the court, but in the Congress. And once it is, we will move forward. That doesn't mean if it is repealed, which I don't think it will be, but if it is, yeah, we'll still have a major set of healthcare issues that we didn't really resolve. Even if the law stays in effect, it's not like that solves everything. There are a bunch of unintended consequences, some of which are already showing up. But the issue at large won't go away, but this judicial question, I think, will be solved, and then we'll move to other matters.
Al,
this is a question, Alan. I mean, it's a legitimate question. I don't know the answer to it. If you strip out the way you finance the program, what is left of the program that you can go ahead with?
Bob?
I think the answer to that is a lot of the organization of setting up cooperatives and things like that can go forward. But the funding mechanism, remember that the funding mechanism which Alan is talking about is the way that the program funds itself. By getting all these folks who now don't have insurance and don't want to buy insurance, requiring them to buy insurance, and these, of course, are mostly young people who are pretty healthy, and the revenue that comes in is going to help to pay for the ever-growing group of older citizens who need the Medicare program and need the health care program. So the fact of the matter is, the law itself, it may only be one piece, but it's the foundation upon which a lot of the program is built. So what it means is we're going to have a program that's sitting out there with some structures you can put together in the various states, the co-ops, and the buying programs. But the fact of the matter is we're going to have to find a way to finance the program, and the way, if that program is found to be unconstitutional, we're going to have a real problem trying to figure out how to fund any Medicaid.
You know,
program.
When we talk about this particular subject, you know, one of the subjects that we brought up before is we always revert back to the last time there was a bipartisan agreement on national health care, and that was the old Nixon-Kennedy bill from back in 72, which was probably the closest this country came to actually having a true nationalized health care system available to all. Is this now, I mean, if in fact the Supreme Court were to repeal or overrule the circuits and the appellates, Alan, is this maybe the right time for all parties at the table, all the stakeholders to come together and say, look, let's go back and look at that 72 bill. It was only defeated on a technicality, but had widespread bipartisan support. Why wouldn't the parties at the table go back to that effort, or is that a lost cause?
Well, yeah, let me confess that I don't recall what was in that bill, but I can tell you this, in 40 years, a lot's changed in healthcare in America. So anything that's 40 years old is probably not the right framework. Remember where we started with this. Obama wanted a single-payer system. Hillary Clinton wanted a compulsory everybody has to come in, which Obama ridiculed during the Obama-Clinton debates. And then suddenly when it was clear that a single-payer, Medicare-like system for all was not going to work and not going to be a successful option, then the president turned to compulsory insurance. There were Republicans who liked that idea, too, and I don't mean just Mitt Romney for the system from Massachusetts, but there were other candidates who said, this is the way to do it. We have to get everybody into the system so that we can all benefit. We can't let people cherry pick.
But under the health care, there are you do have the ability to opt out. What happens if all the healthy people decide they're going to opt out and go private, and then all you have is the sick people or the people with the pre-existing conditions? That was one of the main issues.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a quick break here. Apparently, Washington, D.C. Fire Department's Tactical Rescue Unit just showed up in front of the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics.
Yeah.
We're going to take this opportunity to take about a 3-4 minute break. When we come back,
if we come back, apparently,
we may be going out on a tactical rescue. By the way, that's a big Stokes litter for my ass. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the political side of this. And does this, in fact, make... I said, that's not as bad as some of the bombs you've dropped recently, Congressman. We want to talk about the political side and the political ramifications for 2012. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, at least for now, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Response unit has left, and we're still here. So, and during the conversation,
you guys should start smoking less expensive cigars, more expensive cigars. It's all the smoke from your cigar that caused the
sun out there. Wow. Wow, civility, Congressman. Civility.
It's those white owls.
It's those white owls?
But he has a good lawyer. Don't worry.
Wow. That's harsh. And even though I am the moderator, sometimes the moderator gets overruled. We've decided we're going to move on because Arguably, I mean, this all obviously hinges on what the Supreme Court does. They're going to be politicizing this all along. But the other big news coming out of actually Florida right now is the surprising results of the straw poll in Orlando at Florida's Presidency 5 convention, which is their big presidential year convention for the Republican Party of Florida. Herman Cain with a decisive knockout victory over Rick Perry, who finished a very distant second. Herman Cain, even though his pizza sucked, had a stellar showing in this. Alan, does this surprise you?
Which it's, Alan are you doing?
I said Al. I said Al and Alan, but since Alan's already teed up, go ahead.
No, no, it's all right. Let's go ahead. Yes, it surprises me because he's, you know, he's been getting good reviews but not getting a lot of support. This is the first showing of support to go along with the reviews. Now, the reviews of the reviews have been that it won't last, that that they're still saying he's not a realistic candidate and what have you. And I suspect he's wondering, what do you have to do to get recognized around here? There's a great line from a play that I could use, except it really does use a bad word.
Yeah, can't use it. Can't use it. We're a family-oriented radio show.
But who do you have to do it to get recognized around here?
Alan, your thoughts on Herman Cain?
Well, it was a surprise, but I don't. I think the significance for me is not a plus so much a plus for Cain as a disaster for Perry. He chose to participate, invest, and try to do well. Whereas Romney, for example, who was one, you know, a percentage point behind Perry, left town, said, "Yeah, I don't do straw polls. I've got to focus elsewhere." So it seems to me that this was a vote. If it was Cain versus Perry, if you will, what the voters were saying is, we don't like Perry. We're having a lot of second thoughts about Perry. We're going to go somewhere else. This guy has been here. He's stuck around. And he gave a great speech. And why not vote for him? But I saw it more as a protest, a vote against Perry than a vote for Cain. That's kind of harsh because Cain's out there and give him credit for what he did. But that's my sense of the story.
Ralph.
If you look at the numbers, 70% of the people in the Florida straw poll voted against the two front runners, Romney and Perry. And as Alan correctly pointed out, Romney had spent a lot of time in Florida, so this is a real blow to his campaign.
Did you mean Romney?
You mean Perry?
Romney had spent a lot of time in Florida. And Herman Cain is a wonderful stump speaker, and Romney has become too much of a technocrat, and the question now is, can Romney advance a bold reform agenda that can really jumpstart his campaign coming out of the Florida straw poll?
Well, we're looking at the results, Bob, is this, like Alan said, a vote against Rick Perry and Mitt Romney more so than the Florida voter saying, hey, because the word I got back, I got phone calls right after the straw poll results were announced, people were actually in attendance at Florida Presidency 5, who said that it was like a tent revival. When Herman Cain spoke, he was articulate. He found his base. He got into a groove, and people were up and cheering and just excited about Herman Cain. But is this, in fact, a vote against the front runners versus a large scale, hey, look at me from Herman Cain?
I'd like to know a little bit more about two things. Number one, how many people voted in the straw poll? And number two, who were they? I don't know enough about either one to be able to give you a good answer. I heard some number that it was just, 1,000 people was voting in the straw poll.
Correct.
Now, if it's only 1,000 people, that is so self-selective and so unrepresentative in the state that I would say that it's more a matter of, gee, this is a nice thing to talk about. Gee, somebody got a big number, nobody else got a big number, but it doesn't mean much to me at all.
Really, Al?
Well, you may be the moderator, but you're also the expert on Florida politics, sitting around this table, and I would like to hear your reaction to it.
You know, I got to tell you something. My experience in Florida, particularly with the Republican Party of Florida and these presidential conventions that they have every 4 years, it is, you get a lot of state legislators who show up. You get a lot of the RPOF leadership that show up, and you get a lot of the big money donors that show up at this in Orlando. It is a, traditionally, the presidency five or presidency four, or presidency three, the past ones have always been pretty much a good sign of where the base is looking for their candidate to be. This result has actually gotten a lot of people that I know that are deep embedded with Florida politics very confused, because I think Florida is a huge swing state. We're seeing a definitive split between, you have the Tea Party, you know, the Tea Party loyalists, which out of Orlando, that's Mecca for them. Orlando is Mecca for the Tea Party loyalists. But you're also starting to see out of that I-4 corridor a lot more of the moderates who I think would be very supportive, not so much voting against the frontrunners, Rick Perry or Governor Mitt Romney, but I think they're saying, look, we have other options here. Let's look at what the other options are without preordaining anybody. This is still preseason football, in their opinion. I'm very shocked. I was very shocked when they came back. I was very shocked to hear the reaction of the people that were there. Make no mistake about it, is 1,000 people, those are 1,000 of the most powerful Republicans in the state. They obviously saw something in Herman Cain to at least give them a reason to say, hey, you know, if I voted today, here's my straw. It's I think it's a telltale sign as to not so much the weakness of the front runners, but the strength of some of those that are behind the front runners, i.e. Herman Cain. Bob, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask if it wasn't a statement that everything is relatively fluid and weak at this point, and they're looking for somebody. And there's not so much saying that Herman Cain is the guy, but somebody's got to be the guy.
Well, we're going to talk about who the other two guys might be.
And we've talked
later
about
on the show
today.
I would tell you that there is, look, we've said on the show numerous times that Herman Cain definitely has legitimacy and will be present in the national political picture down the road. Is he going to be the next president? If I'm a betting man, I'm saying no, and I'm pretty sure that's a solid bet. But what we're finding is, because Florida is such a swing state, that it does give a red flag to the front runners, saying, hey, you guys have got to get your act together. Somebody better start coming out of the box real quickly, as opposed to this back and forth, Bachman to Perry, Perry to Romney, Romney to Perry and Bachman. It's a definite wake-up call to the party as a whole for how we're approaching 2012, and we being Republicans, Ralph.
And that's where Romney has to put forth a bold reform agenda to really promote his candidacy and to get the Tea Party and the conservative wing behind him.
I honestly, going off of Florida, just talking specific to Florida, I don't think that's the case. I think what they're looking for is, somebody show me leadership. Somebody show me that you can be presidential, no holds barred. There's no question about it. I mean, Rick Perry in the past three debates has looked like an amateur. He stumbled over himself. He was ill-prepared in his first debate. He's not looking very solid as a viable candidate to go up against the White House. Mitt Romney, on the other hand, I think is holding back. I think Mitt Romney's waiting to show his full hand, you know, when he has to go all in. Is that a smart political move? I don't know. Alan, is that a good political move, or do you even agree with what I'm saying?
Well, I don't know about the holding back part. It's not like he's got some great agenda that he's going to bring forward. He's just been at this now for a long time, and he was a grown-up when he started, and he's become a better and better candidate in these kinds of fora. Does he get people excited? No. Perry got people excited. Bachman got people excited. Palin got people excited until you took a closer look, and then you weren't so excited anymore. And that's what Perry's experiencing now. In the case of Romney, he doesn't get people excited, but he makes them feel comfortable, and that's working really well for him. He's sort of everybody's. He's sort of solid second choice of some of these folks. What he needs is to find a way to generate a little excitement for the Tea Party, but that's not by flip-flopping or coming up with something new. And it may be that the source of his excitement is when he becomes, if and when he becomes the candidate and people rally around him because he's the best there is.
Al, do you think that this is playing well for the Obama administration? I mean, as a Democrat, this has got to be exciting news to you that pretty much the Republicans don't have their quote-unquote electoral house in order.
If it weren't for all the mistakes that the Democrats have been making for months and months and months, the Republicans would have just shot themselves in the foot and have set themselves up to absolutely lose the
2012.
The 2012. Now, Obama's operation has been making mistakes, and that's what gives the Republicans, I think, some hope that they can wiggle through all of this stuff and still come out with a strong campaign in the fall.
Do you think? Well, let me put this question out to everybody. And Bob, I'll go to you specifically. You've been around Republican campaigns for a long time. Does Herman Cain now become a viable possibility for vice president in this case? Does the Republican Party now start going, oh, maybe Marco Rubio is it, but maybe we need to look at a Rust Belt moderate Republican business owner who's got now some credibility?
Well, he has certainly put himself in position to be among the candidates to be looked at this point, because to the extent that he has moved up the ladder, if you will, he's getting more recognition. That's a good thing from his standpoint. And a lot depends on who the candidate is and what the situation is, and we're talking a year from now. I don't know, but I can tell you this, that, you know, let's put it this way. 10 days ago, you would not have asked that question.
Correct.
The point is, we're asking the question today.
Correct. We would have been betting that Marco Rubio is going to be the de facto choice for vice president because it makes sense.
Or the governor of Mexico.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Alan, what do you think? Does this now all of a sudden elevate him to not necessarily front runner status, but credibility as being maybe the back of the ticket?
No.
No? Why?
It's one incident in one place with a handful of people. He's got to do a lot more than win a straw poll where, in my mind, it was more a vote against some of these guys than a vote for him. That's not knocking him. He's a very interesting guy. I just don't see him having the staying power, and I don't think this and this alone suddenly moves him up into the upper ranks. It's still Perry and Romney at this point. We'll talk about Christie in a while. And I think that's it's got everybody's attention. They're trying to figure this out, but I think we shouldn't read too much into this.
It does raise an interesting question, though, of what his, as a vice presidential candidate, would do to the black vote that is uneasy with Obama right now anyway.
Well, you know, it's funny because he has been quoted a couple of times saying that he will get at least a third of the total black vote in a general election because of the fact that he is African American. Whether that's accurate or not, I doubt it, but it's still a very telling sign. We know for a fact that the latest poll numbers coming out on the Obama administration and on President Obama, he's losing traction with the African-American vote. And most likely, those are going to be your moderate, independent, middle-class African-American voters.
This would throw a rock in his room. You know?
Right, right.
Now, there are other considerations the Republicans have to make in trying to siphon off the black vote from a black president may not be the way they want to spend their effort. But it's just interesting that it would throw that up in the air.
Alan's cringing right now. Alan, go ahead.
I'm not cringing. I just think that it's a pipe dream to think that Cain is going to get a third of the black vote. He'll be a Republican if he's on the back of a ticket and it's Obama, the African-American vote will overwhelmingly be for Obama. The thing he could do, though, is rather than siphon off votes, he could reduce the interest among African-Americans, which is already a big problem for Obama. Obama needs that vote, those voters to go to the polls because they vote 90-plus percent for him. And I think that would still be the case even with Kane, or close to it. The question is whether they would say, hey, well, I'm mad at Obama, and I like the fact that we'll still have that we would still have somebody just a heartbeat away. I just don't see it happen.
But let's say, just take Obama. Go ahead.
There are at least a couple of states where a Kane vice presidency could be interesting.
Ohio.
Think of Michigan.
Indiana.
If you had Romney at the top of the ticket and you had Kane as vice president, you might actually win Michigan. And that would, you know, if it's going to be a close election, you're talking about 18 electoral votes.
Which is funny because, theoretically, because of Mitt Romney's history in Michigan, his father being the former governor of Michigan, should theoretically make Michigan a lock for Romney. Putting a Detroit business owner into the mix, it does beg the question, taking race out of it, does a Rust Belt part of the team make sense for delivering what normally would have gone blue states, but only marginally, like Ohio, Michigan, yeah. Illinois, Indiana? Is that credible, in my opinion? Or
he's got proven business experience, which no one can argue with.
Again, his pizzas suck, but he made millions off this.
Right.
And he's an even more successful businessman. He can show out the product.
Right. If anybody can re-stimulate the economy, cry out loud. Yeah,
sounds
just those crap pizza.
Sounds like what our president needs. Selling a credit product.
That's right. You know what? You know the people in Florida? Not that stupid. Because there's some places in Florida where they got crap pizza. They probably appreciate Godfather's pizza. Yes or no? Herman Cain, do we see him in February as still being part of this process? Al?
February. It wouldn't surprise me.
Al?
I don't think so.
Bob?
He may have hit his peak, but I don't know yet.
Ralph?
Yes, I think so, especially if Romney and Harry beat up on each other.
We got a bus, and it's about to back into the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics.
Yeah.
Folks, it's a weird day here in Washington.
Yeah.
It's a weird Tuesday, but you know what? It is Washington. Oh, by the way, everybody, correct answer here is yes, we will still see him as part of the factor. Man, I really went John McLaughlin on that one. I'm sorry, Alan.
Yeah. It's all right.
When
you're much nicer.
I know.
He doesn't know what he's talking about mostly anyway.
Wow. Wait a minute. Before we go to break, we got a caller. Caller from the 727. You're on the air with Backroom Politics. Caller? Okay, caller, we're going to put you back on hold. If you wish to talk, press one at any time, and we'll put you in front of the line.
The bus scared him off.
Yeah, but I scared me off, too. I'm about ready to run out of here. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the non-declared candidates that are starting to influence what's going on here. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love.
It is. What class are you?
Near to the sun in the day, and near to the moon at night, we live in a haze. Living on love and pale moonlight, just you and I, forever and a day. Love will not die.
Begun. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. You know what? It's 8 minutes to five. It's happy hour, kids. We're going to start happy hour a little bit early. It's time to order the Jack, the martinis, the wine, the beer, and everybody else's favorite cigar. Here's the trick. The 2012 race on the Republican side obviously is a free-for-all, but it's even more of a free-for-all when you start bringing in some of the outside influences that are starting to come into this. Namely, the big one that everybody's talking about, especially today. Tonight, he's actually speaking out on the West Coast. But the big 300-pound, or actually 350-pound gorilla, he's basically my size, I like him, is Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey. Everybody is talking about Governor Chris Christie as being, or should be, getting his hat in the ring. They've had money backers holding back money from the major front runners, Perry and Romney, just to wait and see what Governor Christie's going to do. And it's being led by the CEO of Home Depot out of Atlanta. When you've got a situation like this, Bob, you've been around these races for a good long time. How does the Republican Party get its arms wrapped around this? And how does Reince Priebus look at this and go, what are we doing?
Well, I don't think those are the right questions right now.
What are the right questions?
Right question is, does he want to do it? And I don't think he does. I don't think that Chris Christie thinks that he wants to do it. This is not his time. I think that he has a much better chance in the future than he does this time. He doesn't have the background. He probably hasn't got enough financial support. He hasn't been at the national scene long enough. This is his first elected job, I believe.
He doesn't
right.
want to make
he was
the
appointed
Obama
job.
Mistake.
Well, yeah, and I think he'd be very smart to just let this one go. Let's see what happens, because he is a very attractive guy.
Al, say what you just said again into the right mic this time, please.
Oh, yes. Cuddle up to the mic. I just said that it may very well be that he doesn't want to make Obama's mistake. Obama was this very, very attractive, very, very capable, very intelligent guy with high potential, and he may have just jumped in a little too soon.
Al, do you think that, I mean, irrespective of it, now is his time, right now, theoretically, Chris Christie this early, there's still time enough to get a viable candidacy in place if you were to declare in the next, let's say, 60 days. Is that accurate?
Oh, I think that's accurate. You can see that with what happened with Perry. You know, 60 to 45 days ago, he wasn't in. Suddenly he's in. He soars high and he starts coming back down to earth. There's time. Now, I agree with Bob, though, that everything we've ever heard from him says, I'm not ready to do this. And partly he doesn't want to make, while he's holding a job that's very demanding, and he's got a family that means a lot to him, that he doesn't want to just ignore his state and his family over this next period of time, in addition to all of that time and effort, he would have to learn the national issues and he would have to learn international issues. It is more than he wants to do at this point. I'll be flabbergasted if he jumps in. Having said that, he, I think, makes for an interesting vice presidential candidate for a couple of people, not least of all a Mitt Romney, who could use sort of the excitement that the concept of Christie brings to the table, but I don't see him jumping in.
Ralph?
Christie has gone on the record saying that he's not ready to be president. Now, why after 4 months is he suddenly ready to be president?
Well, he's not said that. I mean, he said even as late as yesterday in a town hall meeting in New Jersey, he said, look, I am not running. This guy has said dozens and dozens of times, I don't want to run for president. Right. He wants to be governor of New Jersey.
My point was, he had said initially he's not ready to be president. So if all of a sudden he now, after 4 months, decides he's going to run for president, it doesn't help him at all.
For those of you out there in Radio Land, give us a second here because I want to order. Can I get my Jack and water, please, Sonia? It's happy hour, guys. It's time.
Oh,
we need it.
And the martini.
The martini.
And the beer.
Wine. Beer. Beer. What are you going to have, Beth?
With a cigar right now.
There we go. So we got that going. We've ordered our cigars. We've ordered our beer.
Now back to work.
Now back to work, kids. Back to work. So anyway, okay, so Governor Chris Christie has said numerous times, look, I'm not going to run. I'm not ready to run. He has said numerous times, I want to be and still have to be the chief executive of the state of New Jersey. Is there anything that anybody could foresee that would get Chris Christie into the fold? What possible thing could there be out there to get him to change his mind and say, yeah, all right, I'll do it? Alan?
I don't know. I don't think he's going to do it. So I don't, maybe if, some horrible tragedy occurred for some one of the leaders, but I don't see it happening. It's flattering. It puts the spotlight on him for a while. He gets a little bit of a feeling for that. For his future education, that's my hunch.
Al?
Well, turn it around. What does he risk by not going? It seems to me that the only thing he really risks is muffing his job as the governor of New Jersey, which, from everything I've heard, is a highly unlikely thing to occur.
Well, his numbers, and we've got a caller on the phone, but his numbers have been up and down. Right now he's at 54% approval rating, which is impressive in New Jersey.
Yeah.
For a Republican, especially one that looks like me. I mean, I got to admit, Chris Christie's a handsome guy. We got a caller on the line. Caller from an unknown area code. You're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, caller? What's your question?
Pretty good. Well, I just had a comment for you. I've been listening to what's going on with the Herman Cain situation, which I find, wow. I think that as far as Christie's concerned, I think he'd be a complete fool to get in this race. Because what is he going to lose? He'd lose his credibility because these people are eating themselves left and right. I think this the Florida Herman Cain winning the straw poll in Florida hurts Mitt Romney because somebody before said Mitt Romney's holding back. He's not holding back on policy. He's holding back on money. Okay, he's looking. Mitt Romney wants to get to a point where he wants to get into the big state elections, and Florida is one of those big states that he wanted to take. And for him not to come out well in a straw poll here, is not good for him because he's not going to win in the small New Hampshire, Iowa states. And I can't see anybody who is in their right mind, the Jeb Bushes, the Chris Christies, the legitimate Republican contenders that could make a really serious run in 2016 getting into this race. Matter of fact, I think that Rick Perry actually had that same kind of perception where it really looked like he was not going to get into this race, and somebody convinced him to get into this race, and he has politically damaged himself beyond belief. So I don't see Christie doing it. If Christie does it, I say go ahead. You know, I mean, he's gonna get eaten inside this field. I think he's gonna leave it alone and he's gonna wait for 2016 because I think that's when you're gonna see Bush and Jeb Bush and people like Christie and like that come out. No, I don't think anybody else with any kind of brains is gonna touch this thing because I think you're gonna be flip-flopping around from candidate to candidate based on what state you're in as you go through this process.
Carl,
go ahead. I'm sorry. Carl,
where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Florida.
You're calling from Florida. Okay.
Yeah.
As a voter in Florida, does a straw poll to you give you or at least reconsider the Herman Cain campaign as being somewhat viable?
No. Herman Cain is a salesman. He's going to give you the 999 deal, and maybe if it's in Detroit, he's going to give you the 888, and Chicago 777. I'm slashing prices for you. You know, I mean, Herman. He's still selling pizza. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he's just, you know, I mean, I don't see Herman Cain. I'm sure he's very motivational as a speaker, and I'm sure that he got those people turned on at the straw poll, but no, I don't see him as being a viable candidate. I see him as throwing a monkey wrench in the Republicans, whoever they're going to pick as their candidate. He's going to throw the monkey wrench in there as well, as are all the rest of them, and cause the person who's going to come in, who's going to be the nominee, to limp along in this thing until he finally gets nominated, and it might be somebody like Romney, and it might be Perry, which would even be worse for the Republican field. I think these people are eating themselves, and I don't really think any of these people, and you can throw Chris Christie into it too. I don't think they can beat Obama. I don't think there's anybody out there who's going to beat Obama.
Caller, Congressman Al's got a question for you.
Go ahead.
A comment. You twice said they're eating themselves, and I thought of the analogy, and I wonder if you would agree with it, that the Republican race right now looks like a bumper car game. They're all in there driving at each other and bouncing off, and you raised the question, why would any sane person want to get into a bumper car game and carry on in that fashion? I don't think you can rise above it, so you'd have to get in there and mix it up.
Alan, go ahead.
Why should this primary season for Republicans be any different than any primary season for either party when it's an open process?
I don't
understand.
This
is the way primaries work.
I don't understand that either, but I've never seen one like this before.
Go
ahead, Carl.
I'm sorry. I think the reason this one's different is because you got the Tea Party and you've got people with very, very extreme views that are going to die out very quickly. You know, I don't know if you guys saw, but Ken Burns just did a piece about the teetotalers back in the Prohibition days, and the similarities were striking and how they just burnt themselves out and just died away. I mean, I think the Tea Party is pretty much dead. They're already starting to flub, and they're already starting to diminish drastically. And I think that's what's going on here. I think that they still have a certain amount of control, but I think when this process is done, they're not going to have any at all. And I think that's why this primary is different than other primaries that you've seen before, because I think that you see Fox News, what's-his-face at Fox, the head of Fox came out last night and tried to say that we're going to move back towards more of a centrist position, as if they weren't, as if they weren't right-wing in their process to begin with. But he's trying to get away from them. They want to push a mainstream candidate, and they can't get that through because you've got all of these. You've got the Bachmans and the Perrys there, and they want to push somebody. They'd love to get Chris Christie into this game.
Well,
they just love to get him in. Go ahead.
We appreciate your comments. Thanks a lot for calling. We're going to put you on hold so you can listen in some more. Please keep listening. Please keep calling in. Appreciate the call.
Thanks.
Caller brings up several good points. I mean, you know, whether you want to call it bumper cars, whether you want to call it cannibalism, as he put it, there's a lot of damage being done by a good number of candidates in the Republican race right now. And the question then becomes is, how does a party put a Band-Aid or possibly repair the beating that they're giving on each other? Or can they, Bob?
Well, just remember what Alan said a few minutes ago. This is a typical situation. It's a party out of the presidential office looking for a candidate. Number of people want to get in. The president is weakened from what he was 3 years ago when he was elected. So there's a lot of people who want to jump in. There's a lot of people who are, some got in early, some got in later, some just got in a few weeks ago, like Governor Perry. But this is not surprising. But one of the ways you test yourself and the public sees candidates is how they do when they battle each other in a confrontational style, as all these debates have gone on lately. So it seems to me this is nothing unusual. I'd be surprised if they were all being very polite to each other.
But I resist the idea that this is any kind of a typical Republican primary. And the caller put his finger on it. The Tea Party is what makes it different.
Really? Alan? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ralph.
And at what point will the Tea Party lose its influence? And that's going to really be a factor in driving Herman Cain's campaign.
I don't know. I'm not as optimistic as the caller was about their immediate disappearance. But they clearly are putting things in the soup that don't taste very good to a lot of people, and the Republican Party's got to deal with
that.
Well,
let's go back and talk about Chris Christie for a second real quick, because, you know, the reality is you've got, even today, former governor of New Jersey, Governor Keene came out, co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. Governor Keene came out and said that he, being Governor Christie, is giving it some serious, serious thought. Now, the question is, Alan, is you still think that that's a mistake, even though a lot of the pundits inside are saying now's the time, we're begging for your type of leadership?
Well, it's not a mistake for him to reconsider. He's a pretty authentic guy. He doesn't say, I'm taking another look, if he doesn't mean that. But I don't think at the end of the day, from everything he said, all the signals and his... He made a quote that told me, or there was a quote that told me he understands a lot about what's ahead of him if he jumps in. And he said, in response to the fact that there are all these money people lined up, he said, yeah, but at 4 a.m. in the freezing cold of Iowa, I'm the one who's going to have to get up and go out to all-day meetings, and maybe my wife, not those guys with the money. I mean, he senses what would be involved, the sort of total jump-in commitment while he's trying to do a job in New Jersey and trying to be a father, and has concluded before, and I think he will reconclude that this is not his time.
Well, and besides, anybody that would make their decision based upon what the pundits are advising, what a pundit is primarily interested in is having a good fight that the pundit can comment on and report on. And it looks like these Lilliputians that are
running Lilliputians
now,
really?
Are beating themselves up so bad that you really got a mess rather than a clear fight. So let's throw a good candidate
but
in there and see
understand
what they
though,
do.
One thing though,
he would be a fool to take their advice.
But understand one thing. It's different if just the Washington inside the Beltway pundits are saying one thing. There's some big money heavy hitters that are traditional Republican donors that are holding back on the front too, waiting to see if they can convince. I mean, when you have a delegation of heavy hitting Republican donors going to your front door saying, look, you really, really, really got to reconsider this, that's a hard argument to push off.
Well, which is why you reconsider before reaffirming your
the fact that I'm not. Which is funny because breaking news is Fox News is now reporting that regardless of the speech tonight, Chris Christie is still not running. And he is convinced and he is firm on that. Which, there's a great quote in Politico today. Gary South in the arena says, Chris Christie, quote, combines the appetite of William Howard Taft and the ego of William Randolph Hearst. Is that... I got to tell you something. I resemble that remark. Anyway, this is Backroom Politics. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We were talking about Governor Chris Christie. There's a couple other candidates we want to talk about that are still in play. But right now we've got a caller on the line. Shane Borges, you're on the air.
Hey, great conversation, you guys. You know, I'm out here in Southern California, and so we're all screwed up anyway. So maybe my getting a kick out of the Republican primary, I'm a conservative, I don't see it as being particularly bitter. In fact, in all primaries, if you remember the primary in 2008 with Hillary and Richard Howard Dean and Obama and everybody calling each other names, remember Bill Clinton in outrage because he was being called a racist, you know, things like this. It's good politics. And us junkies love to see that thing. I don't see it. I agree with your man there, Alan, who says this is the same in every primary. It's expected to get like this. And so we're pretty far out from the elections in 2012. I expect to hear this. But Christie's entry into the race is tough for Romney, and it opens up the field for Perry. I think that's what happens if Christie gets into the race. I don't think he's getting in. I had heard he was going to have a speech in 2 weeks, and I thought, great, he's going to come out in 2 weeks and endorse Mitt Romney. That's what I expect him to do.
It would definitely make sense for him to go to that New England moderate Republican base that Mitt Romney theoretically should bring to the table.
Yeah.
But the question still is, we're still probably 4 months out before Governor Christie, if he is not running, which all bets are that he won't, we're still 4 months out before he actually comes out and does a full-blown endorsement. His endorsement's no question going to hold water. Would you agree with that, Bob?
I think any time a major political figure endorses a candidate, it means something. How much is another question, but it always means something.
Well, this also begs the question. There's another player in this that everybody's been starting to talk about, starting to buzz, is the possibility of an independent run by Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg is still in play. He still has – Bob, if you nod your head anymore – by the way, caller, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Sure.
The idea that Michael Bloomberg could come in as a potential third-party candidate screws everything up for everybody on a scale that makes Ross Perot look like Michelle Bachmann's campaign. Is the possibility of a Michael Bloomberg independent run scary to somebody like you, Alan?
It doesn't scare me, but he's also said it's not going to happen. I take him at his word. It could be interesting. He's an interesting guy. He certainly got his differences with Obama and his differences with the Republican field, but he said, I'm not doing it. So I believe that.
Ralph.
He will be in D.C. tomorrow, speaking before the U.S. Chamber on business issues. So
right.
It's going to be very interesting to see what he does at the end of the day.
Well, Bob, you bring up a good point. You think that somebody like a Michael Bloomberg would have a problem developing any sort of Republican support, especially after the maneuver he pulled to get elected in his Mayor for Life campaign the last couple years ago.
Yeah, I do. I don't think it would work. I mean, I suppose he could develop some support among people who want to defeat Obama, but that's, I mean, a number of people can do that if they're the nominee. I don't see Mr. Bloomberg wanting to do it at all. I don't think he'd have much success at it. I think he's much smarter staying where he is and doing what he is. He's a hell of a good mayor of New York.
Now, the buzz is also still buzzing around a good friend of yours, Bob, Mitch Daniels. Mitch Daniels, a lot of people begging him to come back.
Me too, but he's not going to do it.
Why, Al, why are all the good ones not playing?
Well,
you've got people like, you've got moderates like Mitch Daniels, you've got moderates like Chris Christie, you have possible independents like Michael Bloomberg, arguably Republican or not. Why are all the good ones
I just don't buy the premise of all the good ones. I mean, why is that? Why put down sort of the group that's out there? It's an interesting, varied mix. But, if you want to talk about Daniels, that's one thing. I've known the guy 34 years. We came to the United States Senate together. And I think he's a fabulous human being, and he's very smart.
Is he presidential?
I don't know, but he does. I guess if you can get elected, you're automatically presidential. But it's not a matter of being presidential. It's a matter of whether you have made the judgment that in everything you look at in your life, you're ready to make to do this. And he has said no, and that's no means no. Now he's another interesting vice presidential candidate, a guy like Rick Perry. Who I don't think is going to make it. A guy like Rick Perry who needs some heft behind him, and I don't mean Christie kind of heft,
hey,
would love to have the substance that Mitch Daniels brings, because Mitch is a big guy who's done a lot of stuff in Washington, in the States, very smart guy, who could add a lot to anybody's ticket.
Who would scare, or who theoretically...
Somebody should point out, because we've been making a lot of comments about your size, and this is not television, so...
Would you like me to give my Playboy centerfold description of me?
You can just post it online.
That if we tell people that...
Okay, for those of you out in Radio Land, to make Al happy, I'm about 6 foot, about 340. I'm taller than Chris Christie, not as rotund as Chris Christie.
Approximate proportions of a Sherman tank.
which means that you may be able to start at defensive tackle for the Redskins next week.
Which we'll talk about that when we go to free form. But okay,
you were asking a question.
Before you called me a Sherman tank.
Yes.
Yes, I was asking you a question. I was going to ask from the Democratic side. Who truly, right now, if you were to look in the future, who's the one candidate, declared or not, who would give you the most pause about Obama re-winning the White House, current state of politics as it is?
I think all of the ones that we have decided are not going to run. almost any one of them, I think, would be a powerful candidate. But they should have either decided much sooner, or they better wait, and it looks like they're going to wait. So, of the current class, of the current group running, I think probably in the long run, Mitt Romney will get the nomination, and I don't think he should be taken lightly.
Wow.
Now, we never talked about Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin, do we really need to?
You're exactly right.
You're right. I think there's a reason, because we like to believe that we know what we're talking about. But it does beg the question. I mean, you know, Sarah Palin is still running around on her bus tour to nowhere.
Right.
You know, we still happen to see her every blue moon on Fox nowadays.
Yeah.
There was no pun intended on the bridge to nowhere, right. Bus tour to nowhere. when you look at somebody like Sarah Palin, is Sarah Palin losing her luster enough that she's not quickly not becoming a factor or an element in the Republican side of the House?
Yes.
No, Alan? No, she's not losing her luster. She has long since lost what little luster she might have had.
Wow.
I accept the gentleman's amendment.
She's embroiled in a lawsuit now
over her Joe McGinnis book. Correct,
right.
Correct. I tell you what, we're going to take a real quick break. When we come back, we're going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about the biweekly almost government shutdown that happened in Congress yesterday, which is unto itself a little awkward when you talk about the politics currently going on the Hill. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. And we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're going into the home stretch, last half hour, and when we talk about the last half hour, we're talking this segment about the biweekly Congress almost shut down the government again. Oh, we averted disaster. Thank God, Congress looks like heroes. This one was a little disturbing, though. The fact that they put it on top of a continuing funding bill and a continuing resolution that included funding for FEMA and disaster assistance, which right now FEMA is now down to $100 and change million in the bank to support those efforts. That's a little disturbing. Alan, why would they want to attach to something that possibly controversial or something that kind of hits home for a lot of people that were affected by disasters? This has been an odd year.
Well, what the members of Congress decided to do was to take this continuing resolution to keep government going till mid-November, because we still haven't made all the decisions that are required for funding for the year that will begin October 1st. They said, kick the can down the road 6 weeks, extend everything the way that we've been doing it. Oh, and by the way, let's add a few billion dollars for FEMA to
keep them running disaster operations.
Well, not to keep them running from disaster operations, because it's the end of the fiscal year is 3 days away. So they've got a little bit of money, and it turns out they've got enough money
to get them through Friday.
To get them through Friday, at which point a whole new tranche of money for the
disaster recovery
will show up. When they wanted to add additional money, Republicans said, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that's great, absolutely, and we need to find a way to pay for it.
Yeah.
Because that's the new normal here in town. And a bunch of people said, gee, we've never done it that way before. We've always just pretended like we didn't have to pay for it somehow. All administrations do from time to time, the whole Bush administration, that's the way we paid for wars, and to some extent still do.
Well,
so plenty of precedent. But
we've got a caller on the line.
Okay.
Caller from the 858 area code. You're on with Backroom Politics. Caller? One last time, caller. And we'll put you on hold so you can listen. I want to stay in the moderator space, because obviously the FEMA thing is something that raises home to me. But it does beg the question, though, that, you know, I want to go John McLaughlin. When the FEMA administrator does say that, look, we're running into a situation where we've had an unusual...
You don't sound pompous enough.
Give it a few minutes. I can be as pompous as the best of them.
All right.
The reality is, when the FEMA administrator says, look, we're getting down to the last brass penny, we've got to make certain decisions here. We cannot survive all of the recovery operations that are going on in a very unusual year for natural disasters. We're going to need at least some sort of buffer to maintain the current recovery operations that are underway. To me, it makes sense to fund that, and to me, it would make sense that the White House would put it as a special appropriation instead of tacking it on to a continuing resolution. Now, the question then pops up is, was putting it on a continuing resolution a political maneuver by the Democrats on the Hill to say, okay, you want to play hardball? Check this out. Al?
It's entirely possible. You've got a situation here where if you wanted to add to a bill a little resolution that said we welcome the dawn, there'd be some Republican who would say, now how are we going to pay for that? So it gets into a silly kind of a situation.
Bob is thinking. Bob, why are you sinking in your chair?
Senator Isaacson, on the floor said, and I did not hear it, haven't read it, I've only heard about it, so I do not blame the senator if I misquote him in any way, but essentially he said, we've got to get serious about legislating here. All we're doing is sitting around debating about whether we're going to turn the lights on or off. And I think this is a very positive sign to see a senator with his reputation. He's a very conservative Republican, saying we got to get down to business and stop this horsing around on this little stuff. And this was little stuff.
Alan?
Well, it is relatively small amounts of money in the content of a trillion-dollar budget, but the new hero of presumably backroom politics, Senator Lamar Alexander, who has stepped down
from
leadership. His role of leadership so he can play a more active role in trying to find middle ground and compromise, said on the weekend, hey, everybody knew we were going to do this and we're going to pay for this, and suddenly the Democrats changed their mind and decided to make a big political issue out of it. So there's two sides to this, but I think that it with regard to paying for things, when people said, hey, just a few weeks ago, back in August, this is what we're going to spend next year. Oh, except we're going to tack on other stuff?
See, Alan makes a good point. And your original question was this, could this have just been a
political
ploy on the part of the Democrats? And the answer is, yes, it could well have been. Each side knows exactly the buttons to push on the other side now. And they have become expert at pushing those buttons. Not expert at solving problems, just expert at trying to put the other party in a bad position.
Sort of like an interesting marriage.
Right. Wow.
And in order to save my marriage, I will not comment on that.
Yeah, because Paula, you know, is listening.
But I think we're in a situation where each party is guilty of contributing to the insanity that is going on in Congress. And in any given instance, they're not both responsible. They kind of take turns. Bob,
go ahead.
I don't know whether it was a Democratic ploy or whatever. And it really makes little difference to me whether it is or isn't. But I think that the Republicans, particularly the Tea Party folks. I mean, I am not one of these people who thinks all the Tea Party folks are crazy nuts. I think they came here wanting to cut back the government, and there's a lot of reasons to want to cut back the government. There's a lot of wasted money. We all know that. But the fact of the matter is, this was not really a good place to cause a hiccup, if you will, in the process. Now, when you're talking about a continuing resolution for, let's say, 6 months. We all at this table know there will be no budget
for 2013.
No. It won't. There's no way there's going to be a budget. So the fact of the matter is, we're going to have a continuing resolution to carry us forward, no matter what, once October 4th gets here. The fact of the matter is, that's a time when you may want to say we're going to suggest some other cuts in programs because it makes some sense now. But to do it on this very small item, which, number one, can be used to say, look, you know, the Republicans are against, you know, letting FEMA get their money out and helping people in need. I think it was not a good idea to do it the way they did.
Ralph.
And I was kind of surprised with Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News Sunday, because he kept insisting that, you know, in your personal life, when you're going through a disaster, you can't go to the government to get money. So why make this big issue of a disaster funding? I mean, at the end of the day, he was willing to support it, but he was chastised.
I don't necessarily agree.
What I heard Graham say was that in your personal life, if you run into a disaster, you find something to cut back on in order to deal with the disaster, and that's all that that was going on here. What I found interesting in all of this
was suggesting we cut back on disasters.
No.
Well, at the end of the day, he was going to
support that. No,
he
was going to
support it, but
he was going to say we have to find a way to pay for it.
Right.
That's what you have to do in your personal life, and that's what government has moved away from and needs to move back.
So basically, he was suggesting offset spending for disaster response.
That's right. Now, what I found interesting was that leading up to the bill that the House passed and then the Senate blew off. Before we all discovered, oh, maybe FEMA doesn't need the extra money and we can put this down the road. There was a very interesting that happened in the House of Representatives, and that is that the leadership brought forward this bill, and it couldn't pass it. This was just last week. It lost a large group of conservative Republicans who said, no, we're still spending too much. So Boehner brought the Republican caucus together, and he said, you guys have a choice to make. You support me in this effort, or you force me to go cut a deal with the Democrats where we will not have as good an outcome. It's your choice. I am not going to be party to shutting down the government over this. So at which point, a number of the Republicans stood up and said, I get it. I've got to take this proposal because it's the least bad alternative, and if I make my guys lose, I'm going to get something I like even less because you're going to have to go cut a deal with the Democrats. I'll sign up.
Al, you were raising your hand like you were in a tent revival.
The fact is that 99% of the votes that members of Congress take on the floor is to choose between the least bad option. And John Kennedy put it beautifully once, and I can't possibly remember what it was. But the fact is, the public,
it was brilliant.
It was brilliant.
Well,
but you sure Dick Nixon didn't say it?
Bob, I was about to say something uncivil about it.
Don't go there.
The point. It has now been lost by the interjection of the gentleman from Ohio.
Wow.
You saved him from himself.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
You saved me from a bit of brilliance.
I was trying to help you.
You know, Al, I got to tell you something. You know, I love your stories. I love your analogies. When you come and say, this was a brilliant thing, and I can't remember what it was. It's almost very Yogi Berra-ish.
Well, but we digress.
You all are ornery today.
Now,
is that better?
Now,
than that?
Yogi Swift.
Now repaid me for the Sherman tank tops. And we're even.
You're darn right. I'm the moderator. I can do this. John McLaughlin's got nothing on me. Anyway, bottom line here is, the continuing resolution, when we look at the bill that was passed last minute, last night in a vote in the Senate, one would think that this almost is putting either more or less pressure on the super committee that they're going to have to come up with some sort of true cognizant resolution that's going to be a pill that everybody can swallow. Does the continuing resolution vote in the House kind of neuter a little bit the super committee, or does it reinforce the super committee? Bob?
I think the super committee has enough troubles right now by itself. I don't know. It doesn't make it any easier to see the original bill in the House go down because of the disagreement between the Tea Party and their own leadership. But the fact of the matter is, the super committees, given the fact that the president has gone into campaign mode, it makes it all the more difficult to find a way to put together anything at the super committee level that is going to be a bipartisan success.
Al,
and that's a problem.
We Al, what are your thoughts on that?
That the president has gone into campaign. Let's see, who was it that said our primary responsibility in Congress this year is to see that the president doesn't get reelected?
Wasn't me.
But, no, it wasn't you. But it was the leader of your party in the Senate. As I said last week, we have moved from policy into politics. And so you're
That's
right.
That's what I'm saying.
the president responds, but you say the president like this is something new. He's finally responding to the Republicans who have been political all this year, since the beginning of the Congress.
Alan.
Nothing to add to that.
He dismisses me out of hand.
No.
Al, me as well.
Folks, you're now witnessing the evolution of backroom politics, folks. Just listen up. It only gets better from here.
Let me do a little preaching right here.
Okay.
What we've just been through is a place in which this group seriously disagrees on something and could do so with laughter, having made their point, I think, quite clearly, and we disagree, and we're not mad at each other. And that's one of the things that we really need the people in Congress to learn, that you can disagree, and you can disagree strongly, and you make your point as strongly as you can, and then you go out for a drink. Or, in our case,
you have a drink while you're on the air.
Yes, right. Do both.
But why is this? Why is this concept?
I think we should have a bar on the floor of the House and the Senate.
I think the Democrats and President Obama are frustrated because they don't feel they have any willing partners in the House or Senate to help them pass a true jobs agenda. I mean, it's very frustrating.
That, but why? We've been on the air now for almost a year. We've been talking about this subject that Al brings up for over a year. And we've been doing it long before when it was just three or four of us around a table drinking martinis, in my case Jack Daniels, smoking cigars, and complaining about what needs to happen in Congress. Why is this so difficult for Congress to get its arms wrapped around? It seems like that. It seems to me that this is something that Congress could absolutely embrace. It's a concept that they can absolutely come to the table with and show productive results in the way that they govern and legislate.
But when you go negative...
But again, I ask the question, why is this such a difficult concept?
I don't understand it, because I think every incumbent, Republican and Democrat, is putting themselves in jeopardy by behaving in this fashion. I think you're going to have a huge anti-incumbent vote that's going to hit both parties, because they're sick and tired of bickering and having big fights over whether you turn on the lights. So I have no answer to your question.
Bob, why is this so difficult a concept to grasp?
Well, of course, several weeks ago, we spent 2 hours talking about
the problems
of how it got the way it is, and we offered some suggestions. Let me follow up on what Al was going to say. What Al said about, you know, a whole bunch of people, right, left, and center, being removed. I'm not so sure that wouldn't even be worse than leaving the people we have in. At least the people who are in now have gone through this veil of tears and seen how destructive and worthless it is. Maybe a new bunch of people wouldn't be any better, because they don't understand how Congress works. They don't understand the need to work across the aisle. I'm not so sure that... One of the things I've always been opposed to is term limits, because I've always thought that you need experienced hands, at least understand, and who know each other can work out deals. We don't do it anymore. I don't know that a new group would be any better than this one.
Al?
But I have been... had the idea, and I've talked to at least two candidates, one Republican, one Democrat, that it's possible that it might be a wise political decision as well as a good policy decision to essentially run against all the squabbling and say that I will not give up my views on these various issues, but I will not... take everything personally and get down into the ditches and bite this out like a bunch of cats.
That would be an improvement.
That would be an improvement.
Those
kinds
of new legislators,
but Alan, you know,
dedicated to that would not be ones that would be advocating things that an irresponsible, uneducated group would do. it'd be very different than the
But Alan, I mean, Alan, when we talk about term limits, one of the big people one of the big arguments that people who are against term limits say that if you put in term limits, the power doesn't go to the member. The power becomes you have, you know, 1,000 staffers running around running Congress instead of the members running Congress.
Well, that's one of the problems right now.
That's all. It first of all, staff serve members who are in office, and if your boss goes, you go.
Right.
And it's not true in every single solitary case, but if you're a person like me who's decided early on in your career to hitch your wagon to the star of an elected official, you can win and you can lose in a heartbeat. I was working in the Ford White House, and I was on the street on a November day when the results of that election came out. I almost lost my job when I was working in the Senate, when my boss, former Senator John Danforth, came within a whisker of losing in a re-election race. When I was a Reagan appointee and Bush won, the Bush people came in and said, "You people are terrific. Thank you very much for your service. There's the door." And so it's not as though you've got a permanent class of staff who are going to be in charge. They serve
at the pleasure of the elected official of
their bosses.
But it's been widely seen. I mean, we see the revolving door where a staffer will leave a member who's lost and get picked up by a member who's won. We've seen members switch in between terms to find the better deal, the better candidate, the better boss. There's been a long-standing kind of feel sometimes for those who are against term limits that, in fact, as we said earlier, staff runs Congress. Congress doesn't run Congress.
No, it's just not true. It's just not true. And I think, you know, let Al speak. He's a member of Congress. He's, you know, it's one thing to say staff have a lot of power because they're given power and members rely on them. But members have the power.
And I'm against term limits, and you didn't name any of the reasons. And I won't go into my reasons. They're
right.
A little bit more philosophical. But the fact is that I think what's happening is the members of Congress are listening to the wrong staff. Members of Congress have two staffs. They have their policy staff, and they have their political staff. Both are necessary. But the political staffs on the two congressional campaign committees, the Republicans and the Democrats, have become awesomely powerful. And I think that the parties are paying more attention to their political staff's advice of this is what you should do to get reelected rather than this is what you should do to make good policy. My view is political staff is supposed to tell you how you should defend what you've done, not tell you what to do. Your policy staff is the one that advises you on what is good, proper policy, and then the political staff should say, now you voted this way and this way and this way. Now these are the best ways to present that to the public.
But Bob, I mean, what Al's saying, although true or should be true in many instances, is completely ideological. It's not reality, which is part of the problem that we're dealing with possibly right now in Congress. I go back to the original question, though. When we look at now having to go into our second possible full year of running government under a continuing resolution, we did it in fiscal year 11, all right, we've done it in fiscal year 11, we're about to do it in fiscal year 12. More than likely, this could possibly carry over until after the November elections into 13. Because we're going to be wound to the budget cycle for 13 once the November election comes around. Why is it still so difficult?
Well, I think Plouffe made an interesting point, saying you have roughly 30 Tea Party members of Congress who are, in effect, wielding great political power. They're controlling the debate on taxes and budget. And the whole approach by the Republican Party is how can we keep these people happy rather than looking at the benefit of the country as a whole, getting everyone to work across party lines and to bring people together and solve problems.
Possibly.
Yeah, fine. That's David Plouffe's view. I think it's nonsense.
Why?
There's not 30 people who are running things. There's 87 freshman Republicans that Boehner has to pay attention to, and when it came to the debt limit deal, 2/3 of them came over and voted with him to pass the debt limit.
Exactly.
These guys, as brother Yogi Al here said, was everybody has to learn how it works, whether it's a president, and every president has got a lot of learning to do, even if they were vice president before, and every member of Congress has to learn what to do. That doesn't mean that they all learn in the same way, they all come in with the same viewpoint, and they all end up in the same place, but we're watching this messy, messy process of learning and change occur. But
and it's only destined to get worse if we have a let's throw the bums out in 2012. We got a possibility that we could see total gridlock.
See, I agree with you. I always opposed to throw the bums out, partly because I went through two elections in which I was
the bum.
They just throw out. For exactly the reasons you state. But what I am suggesting is that I believe the current members of some of the current members of Congress have been breathing a wart on their nose for months and have not seen it coming. And I think they are creating a situation in which throw the bums out is a more likely attitude than let's evaluate our member and see if we want to reelect
him. Bob, I'll give you the last word on this.
I want to follow up real quickly on what Alan was saying because it's interesting. Earlier on, let's say 6 months ago, there were a heck of a lot more than 31 or 2 Republicans, newer members, who were not working with the Speaker as well as they ought to be.
Right.
Now, granted, this is a relatively small number and it wasn't a big deal, but there's only 30 of them who went that way. Now, that's they're showing me there's some progress there. The Speaker still does not have control of the caucus in the way most speakers have always had with that huge number that came in. But the fact of the matter is, more and more, they seem to be beginning to learn a little bit about how if the team all works together, they may not get everything they want, but they're going to be a lot more successful if they play the game that way and work together than they do if they splinter off. Hopefully, that will be the case going forward. We'll know before the end of the year.
And that which gets me back to the point that I ruined by saying I couldn't quote John Kennedy properly, and that is that what most politicians and members of Congress are certainly faced with is not a choice between the glorious righteousness of the perfect solution and the dreadful thing that the devil concocted. It is always going to be something that you voted for with reservations or you voted against with reservations.
It's ironic. It's ironic that we're saying the stuff we are because right now CNN is reporting the CEO of Coca-Cola just went on record in a speech this afternoon saying that we cannot have polarizing gridlock in Congress. The CEO of Coca-Cola is saying that we are destroying our own credibility by having politics as usual in Washington, and that's something that we've got to fix.
I think that's going to grow.
I think we're going to see more CEOs, more and more CEOs coming out with that.
And Senator Isaacson.
I agree. It's 5 minutes till closing time, kids, and it's my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story time, where we talk about the buzz, the conjecture, any of the stuff we've heard around the Beltway that we can scoop either Politico, CNN, because we all know that they're listening to the show. They just don't want to admit it. where we go around the table and we tell a story that nobody else knows. I'm going to start with Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
You will recall that when we were talking before the show started, I said I wanted to talk about the decision of the court down there and the Justice Department because I thought it would be a big political issue, the Obama health care bill in the next election. And we talked about that for the first hour, so there's nothing more for me to say.
There we go. Alan.
There's a debate now with the president's rhetoric about jobs and taxes, and is he engaging in class warfare or not? And I would venture to say that so far he is, because he demonizes all millionaires and billionaires, and I predict that he is going to modify that ever so slightly. He's got plenty of millionaire supporters, and he's going to say, for those millionaires who are not paying their fair share, watch out, we're coming after you, instead of demonizing them
all. Millionaires, right? Like absolutely. Barbara Streisand.
Absolutely.
What's wrong with demonizing boys?
Well, I guess your political check's not going to be coming from Babs, is it? Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay. The Senate will pass a bipartisan measure dealing with trade and tariffs on China. Obama will be forced into a position where he's going to have to veto such measure.
Wow. Interesting.
Okay.
That's going to have political ramifications.
Right.
Al, tell me a story.
This is more of a hope than a prediction.
Okay.
But I see some glimmers of hope. And that is, and we've discussed it earlier in the show, that and you just mentioned Coca-Cola, I mentioned Senator Isaacson. I think there are other sensible people that are coming and going to put pressure on the Congress to grow up, get a scout leader somewhere, and do their jobs rather than spending all their time trying to figure out how to get reelected.
Wow. My story is that hearing the results in Florida, hearing the successful run of Herman Cain in the Florida straw poll, the folks in Florida were saying that one of the key things that everybody is begging for, at least in Florida, and I'm sure it will resonate throughout the country, is somebody's got to stand up to show leadership. Leadership is going to be a political campaign issue in the next coming few months. It's going to be, let me show you how I can lead this country, lead my political agenda. Let me show you how I can lead resolution to a lot of the problems in Washington. Mark my words, this is something that all the campaigns, at least on the Republican side, are buzzing about, and they're starting to come up with talking points about. Watch it coming out. That brings us to the end of another great yet somewhat Sherman Tank, really? Wow.
No.
Wow.
But I don't know of a smaller tank.
I'm sorry. I didn't know it was going to be called an armored personnel carrier.
But a very small one.
But a very small one. I still think Chris Christie's a handsome-looking man. And he's got a governor's mansion, damn it. Basically, he's me in a governor's mansion. On behalf of...
He's you or the governor's mansion.
Wow. I carry it well, genius. I carry it well. On behalf of Al, the Honorable Alan Moore.
Said with a sneer.
Why is he honorable?
Yeah, you lost honor then. On behalf of Congressman Al, the Honorable Alan Moore, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am your host, Radio's Justin Russell.
Alan.
I said Alan.
You
wow. I'll give you the Larry King mic if you want. On behalf of everybody at Backroom Politics, thanks for joining us. We'll be back next Tuesday, 4 o'clock Eastern Time, as we are every Tuesday. And, really, Sherman Tank. I'm going to have to come in camouflage next week. Folks, have a good week. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.